I'm happy to be back here at a spiritual home. For a long time in the 90s, I guess this is the only Dharma center that I ever taught at. And then since then, I've been teaching it at quite a few other places. And I thought, well, maybe they're just tired of me over there at the Learning Center. But I somehow managed to get myself invited back, and I'm really happy to be here. And I thank you all for coming and listening to me, which gives me the opportunity to go over these. It helps me by having somebody to listen to me try to sort these things out. We're going to say any like prayers or chanting or something. Yes. Is that now?
Now.
Now.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we'll start with the, we have the four-line verse there of refuge and bodhicitta that we say three times before we begin. So, I go for refuge and eternal enlightenment to the Buddha, the teaching, and the spiritual community. By the merit of listening to the teachings, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all living beings. I go for refuge until enlightenment to the Buddha and the teaching and the spiritual community. By the merit of listening to teachings, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all living beings. I go for refuge until enlightenment to the Buddha, the teaching, and the spiritual community. By the merit of listening to the teachings, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all living beings.
Okay. Yeah, so that's our motivation, and that's a place to start. A long, long, long time ago, when I was just starting to study Buddhism at the University of Virginia, Harvey Aronson was my teacher, and he said, well, you know, if you're going to be studying Buddhism, you should go find a Buddhist and talk to them. Interview them. See what talking to a Buddhist is like. So I found Betsy Napper and cornered her in the hall and said, are you a Buddhist? And she said, yeah. And I said, so are you trying to get to Nirvana or something? You know, I was like this level of understanding. And she was embarrassed by the question. And she said, well, we're just trying to figure out some way to be helpful. And so then I like noticed that like, oh, that's really, it's an interesting choice of words. And then I noticed that this is like, all the time what Buddhists are saying is like of thinking about what kinds of actions are helpful and what kinds of actions are unhelpful. And there's this kind of ongoing, you know, barometer or feedback loop in terms of like, I'll see what kinds of things are working. And working, of course, means working in terms of alleviating suffering. This is where our teacher, the Buddha, began. The first thing that he spoke about was suffering, not just in the sense of pain, which is so terrible to think about how pervasive it is and how severe it can be, but that also even when we like work really hard to get something, then it very quickly we find ourselves not satisfied. Like I've had the experience often of like working really hard to say publish a book. And by the time the thing comes out, I don't feel any satisfaction in it at all. And I think that if it's like that with a book, then, you know, it's like that when people buy cars and buy houses. It's like there's this sense that there'll be some fulfillment in getting this thing. But then, like, it's like that sense of fulfillment is already somehow exhausted in the process of getting it. And then you're already, like, beginning to see what's wrong with it as soon as you have it. That's how I feel anyway. I don't know if everybody feels like the same way, but this is like, of course, this subtle sense of dissatisfaction or pervasive unsatisfactoriness. It's like it's a sense of, you know, well, Marx talked about it in terms of alienation or a sense of kind of existential unease, if you know, that people, we just don't somehow, even when we're getting what we want, and we can't seem to fully find ourselves at home in our own skin. And This is, of course, something that the Buddha noticed a very long time ago and began to like talk about at the, as this very starting point. It's like, well, the whole purpose of this teaching is to try to address, identify the causes of the situation and see what can be done about it. And in our cases, as we just recited, you know, the idea is to, is the aim is to come to embody the most perfect and pure possible forms of wisdom and compassion, so that we would have like the greatest possible power to alleviate the all different kinds of suffering of living beings. So how can we be helpful? It's like, that's what the first Buddhist I talked to said, right? How can we be helpful is the point. And when His Holiness was teaching about, at Lehi actually, he's teaching about generosity. He was talking about like, well, how can we help other people? And he said, well, if someone needs some place to sit, you can offer them. If they need help standing, then you can help them with that. Whatever they seem, people need all kinds of things. They're always in very many different kinds of unease and discomfort due to all different kinds of circumstances. And so it's not, you know, necessarily the way it's like, well, they have these trivial little worldly concerns and let them sort it out. I'll just talk to them about reality. But the Bodhisattva is engaged in trying to be helpful to beings in terms of like what's pressing in on their minds and needs to be addressed in order to make it possible for them to be in a situation to listen to the teachings and get at a deeper kind of help. So that is, of course, the idea is like that the very deepest kind of help that we can give others is to give them some kind, something that goes at the heart of their problems and not just their immediate problems, and that would be teaching them about the nature of reality. This like Tsongkhapa praises the Buddha for having nothing that does not tend toward peace. That is, all of your teachings are directed towards helping ease, alleviate, calm the pangs, you know, of misery of living beings. That's the point, really, of our whole enterprise. And I was saying, well, if people don't, you know, it's like, in other words, it's like if people don't really care about this and say, well, people suffer, so, you know, que sera. That could be a philosophy of life. I mean, you know, if you don't care about suffering, then I think then you're sort of, you're not bought into the first premise of the whole operation from the beginning. And I'm just like, well, what kind of beings would that be like that just would not care at all? I guess if you're born in a God realm or something that's like that, where it's just, you have so much pleasure all the time that you're not, it's very, very difficult to notice anything unsatisfactory about the situation. And so you're just sort of distracted, you know, that's the idea of a situation where it's, you don't have something that makes pain or misery of life a kind of a present reality for you enough to get you interested in the problem. Actually, you don't even, you know, it's like, then if you do see, so there's a God over there and they're starting to squirm around on their cushion and stink a little bit. It's not like, oh, let's have compassion for them. Then you like go away from them, right? That's the usual way that they say, because they're getting ready to die. And that's like unfortunate and ugly, but not really something that the other gods want to be around. Well, there, I was thinking about other kinds of creatures like animals and so forth. Like, depending on what kind of animal you are, I mean, it's clear that your capacity to care about the suffering of other beings and your capacity to gain skill in being effective in addressing that suffering to the extent that you care are much more limited than ours, right? So it's like we actually have this sort of phenomenal situation in terms of like, as His Holiness talked about so much at Lehi, that we have this natural capacity to care for others, which we could either suppress or nurture and expand, but it sort of comes for most of us with our birth as humans to have this capacity for empathy. You know, Mencius talked about it in terms of like, oh, anyone who sees a child about to fall in the well will feel at least an instant of alarm and concern, right? And then what they do with that, you know, depends on what they've done with the basic gift of the capacity for empathy that came with their birth. They might choose not to help it, or even to laugh if they've perverted their basic capacity, but that would be unusual, and most people would feel at least some impulse to do something to try to help. And so it's like we have like this sense of finding happiness and satisfaction in response to like caring for others that just comes with being human. So then you wonder if you think, well, why don't people build on that more? I think, you know, people do care a lot about other people and get happiness and satisfaction in caring for other people, but they want to be careful about where they draw the line, right? It's like, so we have a sense of ourselves that, as we'll talk about, you know, we protect very strongly, and then that's reinforced by certain communities of care, but we, like, draw really clear boundaries, like, either at our property line or the border of our nation, you know what I'm saying, or the end of our living beings who have similar DNA to us, you know what I'm saying. And so like, so then you have you're going to say, well, this is the boundary between the ones I care about and the ones that are threatening and potentially dangerous to the ones I care about, right? So what we want to do in Buddhist practice, of course, is try to cultivate and expand this capacity for care, and also the understanding of how to be effective in acting to help others, you know, motivated by that care. So on the one hand, you can say one part of the practice is to do things that weaken our sense of self-cherishing and expand our sense of love and concern for other beings. And on the other hand, figuring out ways of understanding the world at all different kinds of levels that will make us skillful and effective and useful, the most useful possible kinds of helpers of other beings. Okay, that's what I want to say. The most useful kinds of helpers of other beings. So that's like, in this way of saying it, I'm saying like that the heart of the path is really this wish to care and to maximize our caring and our ability to care. And how are we going to maximize our ability to care? We have to have wisdom, which both understands the ultimate root of the problem that's causing people to suffer, but also has refined techniques for being effective in dealing with the immediate situation as it's arising moment by moment, and guiding people into that deeper understanding. So I don't know if you follow, but I'm also just trying to switch this around and make wisdom the means and compassion the core purpose, and wisdom is the means by which we're fulfilling the core purpose of being a bodhisattva. So we have these different kinds of wisdom then, like on the side of trying to fulfill this purpose of care. One that looks at the root of the problem. The root of people's misery and dissatisfaction is having a misapprehension of the way that things exist, of having a false view, it's not just like a philosophical view, but like a reflexive habit of seeing and grasping and clinging onto things as existing in a way that they don't. This is the teaching in Buddhism. So that the deepest kind of wisdom is the wisdom that's the antidote to that root of all needless misery. So that would be the practice of getting to understand. That's the wisdom that gets to understand ultimate reality or emptiness. But at the same time, what if we only had that kind of wisdom? You know, would be very difficult then in just if we understand everything is emptiness but have no other kind of wisdom whatsoever. Well, we'd be stuck with like what kinds of information. We would know what popular opinion in the world is, and we would know that ultimately it was not right, because everything is ultimately empty. But in between, we wouldn't have any way to guide people or give them, oh, it would be, for example, is it more helpful to steal or not to steal? Well, we can look at what popular opinion says, and we can look at what emptiness says. They're both equally and exactly completely empty. So there's not really too much help there. And then if we look at popular opinion, well, we're just going along what the world says, and we don't have any, like, you know, it's like, well, that Wall Street movie, they said greed was good. So that's like, there's how do we sort out, like, which kind of philosophy about stealing and greed should we follow? Because we only have one kind of wisdom, and that says that everything's empty. It's like, how is that going to help us, like, be of any use in guiding people? So my point I'm getting to is that in trying to become the most helpful that we can, it's not enough to just have one kind of wisdom that knows ultimate reality. You have to be able to use the evidence that we have on hand as, you know, as best as we can get at it, which has limitations, right? But always needs refinement and improvement. We have to use the evidence we have on hand and try to make distinctions at the conventional level about, like just Betsy said at the beginning of my learning, right? Well, what's going to be most helpful here in this situation? What's going to be less helpful? And it's like, oh, we thought that would be more helpful, but then it turned out not to be so helpful. Maybe we should try something else, right? So these two kinds of wisdom, one that gives us some practical information about the way things work, and one that looks into the final nature of reality, those, we could talk about these wisdoms are knowing the world in different ways, or knowing the world from different angles. They're both giving us some accurate, useful information about reality that we can use to try to help other people. But they're providing really different kinds of information. And so we talk about this as conventional truth and ultimate truth. That in the domain or the realm of conventional truth, that everything that exists is either a conventional truth or an ultimate truth. And in the realm of conventional truth, you know, we don't want to just say, oh, well, it's all illusion because it's empty. We want to, like, be able to make some distinctions about which kind of conventional truth would it be more useful to engage or bring to bear. How can you be a skillful teacher, you know, if all you just say is everything is empty, end of story? You have to be able to, you see what I'm saying? You have to be able to guide people. Oh, that reminds me of a koan. you can see my teaching is not always strictly Tibetan. So in the Blue Cliff Record, fifth case, the sage of Hermit Peak held up his staff and said, when the ancient ones reached this, why didn't they stay there? And everybody just sat around, like, waiting to hear some further words, since they didn't know what to say. And he said, because it has no power for guidance on the way. So when he says, when the ancient ones reached this, he doesn't mean when they got to my staff, right? When he reached the sheer thisness, the sheer what it isness of things such as this, when they got to this, just as it is, when they saw reality purely and nakedly, just as it was, why didn't they stay there? Because you can't. There's no possibility of helping anybody from within just resting in this, you know, naked apprehension of reality. You have to get up, out, like Buddha did, up from, you know, and just sit under the tree saying, oh, it's so amazing to see things just as they are. He got up and he started, like, talking. And it's like, well, all of those words were gross dualistic signs that referred to gross dualistic concepts, which couldn't possibly express the inconceivable reality that he'd realized. But he did it anyway, right? So what kind of stuff was that? That's what I'm talking about. It's like we have to have some other kind of wisdom besides ultimate wisdom, okay? You need a kind of wisdom that knows the ultimate reality, because that's going to be the antidote to the root of cyclical existence. But in order to help people with that, in order to even get to that yourself, you have to have some other kinds of understanding and analysis, reasoning, that works at the conventional level. understanding that things are ultimately empty, seeing that it's not in the essential nature of things for conventions to be, conventional reality to be, the conventions that the world accepts right now seem to be well established to us, that there are such things as translations or dharma centers or countries or people, you know, but are these things, everything that you think of, right? Okay, all the things that we can bring to mind or think of, justice, everything that we bring to mind, is like we have these conventionally established things that when you analyze, well, what is it really? You can never find anything that's graspable behind it. But when you understand that everything's empty, you understand that the stuff that we talk about and people and chairs and tables and worlds, it doesn't mean that they don't exist, but they don't have it built into their essential character objectively from their own side to be just like that. It's just what they are is like something that appears like that from a point of view of a person like us, right? And not so much like that to an ant. I was like, oh, those ants are so stupid. They have that funky ant karma. Of course they wouldn't understand justice. You know, it's like, you know, they see a cup, they probably think that was a mountain. You know, it's like, that's, you know, they'd fall in and, you know, think it was an ocean. It's like, that's because they're stupid little ants, you know? But there's nothing actually, you know, from the ant has, this is not an ant that has any impairment to its faculties. It's a perfect ant. It has all the right ant faculties. It sees things just the way an ant should see things, based on the kind of karma and afflictions that go along with being born as an ant. And that's the way it is with us, you know? So we have our point of view on stuff, and the stuff is like it is from our point of view a certain way, and ants have their point of view on things, right? And so it's not like there's some built into the nature of things that they have to be established objectively in the way that we're perceiving them conventionally. Now, once you understand that by realizing, meditating on emptiness, then what I'm going to say is that at the conventional level, that liberates you to say, okay, well, you know, people take it for granted that things are like X, but they just assume that it's objectively established that things are like that. But we know that it can't be like that. So is this convention of talking about things in a certain way, say, you know, that there are owners and slaves, for example, is that like a useful convention? Or maybe it would be more helpful to break the frame, you know, of patriarchy, or, you know what I'm saying, or homophobia, and say, well, let's see if we could, like, you know, have a different kind of way of organizing things at the conventional level that what would be more helpful, right? And no more or less objectively built into the nature of reality, right? But more helpful in terms of, you know, alleviating suffering. Some people like have used this phrase talking about it's like breaking frame. That we have a certain frame that's given to us in our culture and a certain way of seeing things and what we sort of take for granted and what we expect to see. So we have a kind of what? We project a kind of reality into what really is a set of shared assumptions. But when you understand that all of this has been constructed because you've seen that it's all ultimately empty, then you're kind of liberated to say, well, what would it be like if I just, like, say, Josh, for example, was saying, well, what would it be like if I just don't go to pick up guy at the train station? That would be impossible. Would that be more helpful or less helpful? You know, what would it be like if I just, you know, maybe it would be helpful to people if I just smack Josh in the face with these socks and he would be momentarily taken aback, but maybe this would, like, shake people up and help them see. So, like, you know, they have the Zen stories. It's not just the Zen stories. You have the Kagyupa lineage stories. People do all kinds of things which show that, like, just the way it's not, the most helpful thing is not always the thing that, like, fits in with what everybody expects to have happen. I get the feeling that maybe Geshe Wangyal was a little bit in that, had some of that going on too. Right? Yeah.
Like every day, yeah. Every moment.
Okay. So I don't know if you've noticed, but what I've tried to do here with this first is to go backwards through the idea of Basie's path and result, starting with the idea that of the aim is our result, is to have this perfect capacity to be at most possible helpful to others. And then talking about it as, well, in order to do this, we'll have to practice or cultivate or grow or systematically expand both our ability to care about others and our ability to be effective in helping others. And to grow and expand our ability to help others, we'll have to be able to have accurate understandings both of the ultimate nature of reality and of how things work at the conventional level. So you have the ultimate truth and the conventional truth are the bases, right? And then you practice compassion and wisdom on the basis of this, on the path, and that leads to this idea of being a perfect embodiment of wisdom and compassion when you're awakened. Okay, so that was my idea there, just tell that story backwards to start with from the end forward. Okay, so now what I wanted to read was like the first sentence of the book, Introduction to Emptiness. We suffer unnecessarily because we do not know ourselves. Okay, so I was like a little commentary on that. We suffer unnecessarily. So the idea we've already talked about is that there's suffering, and that's the starting point. And this is like I always tried to start the book with that idea that this is the situation we find ourselves in. Man's got an arrow in his back. It's not like a man is curious about how the world began. No, it's like a man's got an arrow in his back, right? As the story Buddhas tells. And like, okay, what are we going to do now? So I don't know. I was like thinking about the idea that Buddhism is like reality therapy, that it's like, the whole medical metaphor is shot through Buddhism, that Buddha is the physician, the doctor, and the teachings are the medicine, and the sangha is the spiritual community, is all the people who help us. So the whole idea is that we have this sort of spiritual malaise, spiritual sickness or existential sickness. It's in the condition of our being to not to be like to be ill. That's right, to be ill in a certain way, right? And that what's going to fix us is not like some vacation to the beach or some fantasy that takes us away from reality. We have to be cured by actually looking at the way things the way they are. It's like that, the Matrix thing of you want to take the red pill or the blue pill. And it's like, well, if you take the pill that shows your reality, you're going to see a lot of ugly stuff that you've been hiding from, right? But maybe then in the long run, that's the position of Buddhism. It's like, well, unless you face up to sickness and old age and death and impermanence, it's not like those things are going to go away because we're going like this. So I'd rather see what the latest Hollywood film is like. It's like not like those things are going to go away in the meantime. There's a lot about this actually in Tsongkhapa. He starts the whole insight section, the whole last part of the book, by saying, well, you can meditate yourself into an amazing state of bliss. And but when you come out, then you'll have all exactly the same problems that you will before, right? So you're gonna have to like think about what's the, you have to study. You'll have to think about, and meditate that involve thinking while you're meditating. Do thinking meditation where you're thinking about what is really going on here and what are really the problems that. What's the really the source of my problem, and do some kind of analysis. And if you don't do that, then whether you're sort of going to the movies or going to the beach or sitting on the cushion, you're just like temporarily taking leave of absence from the underlying problems that aren't going to go away. Now, some people, like the idea in Buddhism is that we take refuge in reality, in the real nature of things, rather than in turning away from it. And we have, as we've alluded to, this like deeply ingrained tendency to sabotage ourselves or to trap ourselves by not facing reality. And we have to gradually like sort of think about like, well, what are things really like? And then habituate ourselves and get comfortable with that instead of being so terrified and freaked out by it. It goes against the grain. Buddha says a pratiloma. It's like anu, like pratiloma and anuloma. It's like goes against the grain or against the flow. Not, it's not like a comfortable teaching that Buddha said, everything will be okay, you know, if you just come over and like follow these rules. It's more like, you know, no, you know, this is like what I have to tell you is going to be really uncomfortable and you may not, you know, enjoy hearing about it. Pratiloma, anuloma means like, you know, your hair grows in like a certain way. My father would say champagne, real pain. You know, it's like if you pull the hair this way, it doesn't really hurt because that's the way it goes. But if you pull it this way, that's what pratiloma and anuloma means. Buddha's saying, well, my teaching is like pulling the hair back against the grain of where it wants to go. And, you know, it's like that. I was like, well, isn't it Buddhism all about kind of going with the flow? There's this thing that Aitken Roshi has in Zen Master Raven, his last book. He has one of his students ask the Raven, who's the Roshi, isn't Buddhism about, you know, going with the flow? And Aitken Roshi says, I don't think that's a teaching of the Buddha. And so I was thinking about that a little bit. And of course, if and when one is an awake, fully awakened being, one does not sit around thinking and deliberating about how should I help today? And, you know, one spontaneously is responsive. And you can say that, in a sense, that's the point at which you're going with the flow. Because you're going with the flow of the wisdom and compassion that you've become, has become your nature, has become completely like the way you respond to things. But like now, that's just a little, that's a part of our nature, but it's in competition with these, all these other parts. And if we just like go with the flow, we don't know, it's like, are we being guided by delusion or fear or anger or envy or a subtle kind of pride? Or are we really being guided by that, you know, that part of who we are that's coming from wisdom and compassion? So you have to be very conscious about these things in the Buddhist way. You can't just say, well, you know, I'll just stop thinking and let it happen, and that would be better. At least that's the way Tsongkhapa, and also like I think Aitken Roshi, clearly, you know, he's like, oh, the Zen people, they must be for going with the flow because they're all influenced by Taoism, and it's like clearly not some of the best. Think of it that way. Well, okay, so we suffer unnecessarily. I'm up to the third word of the book. We suffer unnecessarily. So we suffer unnecessarily means it's not built into the structure of reality that we have to be miserable. This is the hope part, right? it's like there's, it's not just the first truth. Oh yeah. And then the fourth truth is, yeah, there's still more suffering. That would be very depressing, right? And it's like, no, it's like not the structure of reality that there has to be this kind of suffering. It is our condition. But it's possible to know ourselves. It's possible to see into the nature of things. And in that way, realize that we can be free from these, like gradually become more free from these sort of reflexive habits of exaggerating the kind of nature things have. I said here we suffer unnecessarily because we do not know ourselves. And my critique of that, I think I wrote that even knowing that it wasn't exactly what I wanted to say, but it was just setting up what I wanted to say next. It's like not really because we don't know ourselves. It's because we actively misknow ourselves. But it kind of it works all right to start out because we don't know. If we did know ourselves, then that would obviously wipe out the wrong thought that we have. But the problem isn't just that. Like, for example, does a rock know itself? Does a rock have, you know, existential angst? I was thinking, Well, that's kind of works for a rock, you know. It's like doesn't it's not trapped in cyclic existence. If simply not knowing, that's my point. Simply not knowing doesn't solve anything, but in itself, that absence of utter absence of knowing isn't exactly the problem, because there's a lot of things that you can point to that don't know themselves and yet aren't we don't posit them, the first noble truth in relationship to them either. So to be more precise, it's not that we suffer unnecessarily because we don't know ourselves. We suffer unnecessarily because we have this addiction to a exaggerated, distorted apprehension of who we are. You know, we take ourselves to be objectively or intrinsically real, when in fact we don't have any kind of existence like that at all. Okay. So what's truly distinctive to Buddhism in particular is this idea of emptiness, the idea that the root of all our suffering is this exaggerated conception of how we exist, and the antidote to that is the sheer absence of that false self that we thought that we had. That's emptiness, that lack, that absence of the kind of reality we thought we have, that itself is the ultimate nature of reality. And that is a very peculiar and distinctive claim, you know, to Buddhism. That's what sets Buddhism apart and makes it less popular than some other religions, I think, personally. You know, that's very much against the grain. Now, I explain this to people and I say, well, everything's empty, but what emptiness does is it shows how things are connected. It shows how things work in the world, how things really flow, how the boundaries and artificial borders and exaggerated self over here as set against the other self out there that we think we've set up are not really part of the structure of reality. And then I had students say to me, well, wouldn't it be better if Buddhists just called it fullness then instead of emptiness? Because it's like we're all full and enriched by our connections to one another. Well, I mean, then it's important to understand that, you know, this could have been done. I mean, you could say, well, that would be a skillful way to teach, but you know, it's like maybe that would be, from a marketing point of view, have worked better up to a certain point. Up to a certain point, but what's the down? I mean, the word that we, I, you know, it's like, well, not just being perverse and calling it introduction to emptiness instead of introduction to fullness. It's like, this is actually the word. Shunyata means emptiness, and Dongba Ni in Tibetan means emptiness. It's not like we're superimposing some negative Western idea. It's like, well, this is completely literal, and it's also completely accurate to the meaning. It means an absence. They're saying that an absence is the ultimate nature of reality. Yeah. And so how can that be something positive or good or liberating or uplifting or hopeful? You know, that's where I started the book, and you know, that's obviously a big stumbling block for people at the beginning. Well, the reason it is because it's like if like an example, somebody was like quoting my book to me, it's like if we're suffering unnecessarily because we think that there's a very angry cougar has come down from the hill and gotten loose in the room here, and then this is causing us all distress and confusion, it will be very important to understand the lack of cougar. The absence of cougar would be liberating. And what, you know, we have this, like, we're not superimposing and projecting any cougar, so it doesn't make very much sense. But it's like, well, we're doing something like that. We're artificially projecting and clinging on to something that isn't there, and thereby causing ourselves misery. So therefore, the sheer lack or absence of that which we have deludedly projected, right? That can be like a very powerful liberating thing. Like, so, you know, if people think that they're locked in a prison, and then they find out that they're the ones who moment by moment are keeping the doors locked. And there aren't any real jailers that exist apart from their own mind who are punishing them or keeping them secure. And then you can have a sense of like, oh, it's like, it's not built into the structure of reality that I have to be in this prison. That the absence, you know, of any real bars or locks, except the ones I choose to set up, right, for myself, is like a liberating absence. It's because the problem is our adding something extra on, that the liberating absence of that is the positive, hopeful thing. That's the idea, okay? So there's lots of other examples like that. People say, like, you know, the sky being clear of clouds, you know, the space is naturally and completely pure or empty. Today it's like you can't actually see any clouds, but sometimes, oh, you can see, I can see a little cloud over there. But, you know, that cloud's not part of the structure of the sky. It's just like floating by. So the sky in itself, it's like that. We don't have any stupidness, greediness, you know, fear built into us from the inside out as our very core and essence. We are that way. But it's not like, okay, well, we have to be that way because that's who we are. But we do actually kind of feel like that, you know. It's like, well, this is, I'm just a fearful person. Like, I'll have to be like that. As long as I'm a person, I will be a fearful person because that's my nature as a person. You know, it's like, well, and you can see, like, oh, realizing emptiness could be liberating in that regard. See, you don't have any fixed nature, then you don't have any fixed essential nature as a fearful person or a stupid person or a selfish person, right? So that's why emptiness is like a positive, hopeful, it's like an opening up of the possibilities of what we can become. That's what makes it possible, of course, for us to become, even talk about becoming Buddhas, right? How could we even talk about or imagine becoming perfect embodiments of compassion and wisdom unless we had this idea that some kind of really, really radical transformation were possible, being that we're not very much like that right now, right? So the other example I use in the beginning of the book is addiction. It's like, okay, so why, you know, we have this habit. Bob Thurman, and I don't know if he does this anymore, but he used to talk about truth habits for Denzin. We say usually like conception of true existence, or some people might say like an apprehension of true existence or something like that, but it's a grasping after things as existing really just the way they appear to us. And the word sin doesn't really mean habit, but it is like this. It is like in the sense of an addict having a habit, right? That we're addicted to this grasping onto or clinging onto the objects that we're afraid of or we're attracted to. This is like something that I, you know, talk about in my books, is that it's not just like, oh, we have this delusion and it's just, you know, it's this little confusion about how things exist, but then the rest of our lives go on just fine. It's like, no, this false idea about how we exist and how other beings exist is always getting tangled up with and throwing fuel on the fire of greed and hatred and anger and envy and jealousy and lust. And so it's all making it so that it seems like something that we might want has some kind of like intrinsic desirability to it. And therefore, if Natalie's trying to get it instead of me, then she's an enemy because she's preventing me from getting the thing that when I get it will make me happy. Which could be like anything, right? Maybe I want an orchard. You know, I get my mind set on that orchard. It's like when I have this orchard, because it has some natural goodness from its own side, then I'll feel a sense of peace. I can retire now. Take care of my orchard. Because it like that, you know, it's like, so I project on that. It's not just like an object of desire, but it's like from its own side, a source of happiness. So desire and delusion, it's like, you know, it's like, well, we think of these are two different things, but they're like, well, they're just like so mixed up together, fueling one another, right? And it's clear that like anger and fear and so forth are like this too. It's really, I think a good example, you know, now I think is like road rage. It's like, that son of a bitch, you know, it's like you think of somebody cutting you off in traffic. It's like, then that person seems not just to have been another living being whom we're trying to help. And now we were trying to help them. And then look what they did. Now, it's like even our trying to help them has now been a cause to fuel our being more angry at them. Those ingrates. I was trying to free them from suffering, and now they're cutting me off in traffic. It's like, so they're not just like a person who's, you know, done something that's inconvenienced us briefly. They are, by nature, the kind of person who would do something like that, if you know what I mean, you know. And really, they ought to get what was coming to them as that sort of person, you know. But because I'm such a good Buddhist, I will not smash into them. Which is really what they have coming, you know, because from their own side, by way of their own nature, they're just really, a very bad person. They're the kind of person who would do something like that by nature. You see what I'm saying? I was like, oh, well, that's kind of funny. But, you know, of course, it's not if there's a gun involved. And then when you have countries, there are always guns involved. Those people from Transylvania. What have they done now? You know, they're all vampires over there. Or whatever, you know. It's like every one of them is just like a little Hitler, you know. And it's like, I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's like we, and this is, of course, and the government says, yeah, yeah, they're just like Hitler. Yeah, no, they're like Satan. No, they're so bad, you know. They're just like vermin. You know, we should just go and exterminate them all so that the world can be free. Of course, it's not that Buddhists don't do this too. Buddhists do it, they call them enemies of the Dharma. People who will make it inconvenient for a Dharma realm to prosper are enemies of the Dharma. And we will be very compassionate when we send our tanks out, you know, to keep them from encroaching into the mandala where we're propagating the teachings, right? Mm. So, you know, anyway, obviously the delusion in the sense of this reified sense of how things is then tangled up with all the other afflictions and leads us into actions. And those actions create who we are going forward. It's not just like, oh, you know, you did this bad thing and so in some future lifetime you'll get that. You know, it's like you are now the person who did that. That's kind of like, well, you can't undo being the person who did that. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, that's how, again, it's like, oh, I want to go back in time and like make a different choice there. It's like, you know. So, there are things you can do to minimize the effect on your character, on your mind going forward. You can regret that you did it, for one thing, right? That's really important. That's the crucial thing, because we're not like going to immediately realize emptiness and pour the fire of non-dualistic wisdom on all these bad karma seeds and have them all burn up. You know, that's a prospect or an aim, not a likely reality like in the next few minutes. And in the meantime, we're just piling up all these like these negative actions. So, yeah, we have to cultivate a sense of regret about them. Regret in, you know, all kinds of Buddhism. It was like the force of the actions that we've choose to engage in on the basis of the afflictions becomes very powerful if we don't regret the negative actions. If we regret them, it's like, well, it's not, this doesn't like make them so they never happen, but it prevents them from having, driving us to, you know, bad rebirths in the future. It's vastly ameliorating, right, and suppressing to the negative effects. Now you're a person who did something but is really sorry that you did, which is different from being a person who did it and said, oh, well, what the hell? You know what I'm saying? That's different. Yeah. Mm. So, It's kind of reality therapy, trying to cure ourselves and help others by putting them more in tune with how things actually are, means seeing a kind of lack or a void or an emptiness in things that we're not really used to being tuned into seeing. There's this extra kind of existence that we've anxiously or fearfully or greedily projected into things, and the lack of that is what we're trying to get at. The emptiness. André Breton, the surrealist, said, "The imagined is what tends to become real," which I think is always a great quote to think about in the context of Buddhism. The imagined is what tends to become real. So, is that true in Buddhism or not? I think it's like really powerfully almost true. The way in which it's not true is that we've been, according to the traditional Buddhist approach, we've been, all of us, beginninglessly imagining that things existed objectively from their own side. And it hasn't made it true. Because it's not possible. It's like self-contradictory. It's actually like, you know, we're imagining something that is demonstrably impossible. It's just like you can't really have a being that exists intrinsically. It's like we have an idea of it, but actually everything exists interdependently. And so no matter how much we keep imagining things that exist intrinsically in and of themselves, we just can't seem to make it come about. We need to amp up our delusion to a higher level, you know, so that we could project some inherent existence into things. Because so far, infinite amount of effort hasn't worked. But if we leave aside cases like that, right, then what? It's like, yeah, if something's possible, then turning your mind to it, focusing on it, cultivating it, right, does create a tendency. It doesn't mean all of, like, you know, you can change things instantly by just whatever you think. But yeah, there's a great deal of power. And this is what the Buddha taught. The mind creates the world. Who created the world? It must be some, like, Ishvara. Some must be some god, you know, or something that was there at the beginning of creator. And Buddha said, well, if you're wondering about where the world came from, I can tell you that the mind creates the world. The mind leads the world, right? So what we're doing with the mind, the kinds of things we're imagining or praying for or hoping for or wishing to see come about. I wish I could get that orchard, right? Or wish I could be a bird in my next lifetime. What, not necessarily a good thing. Whatever it is we're thinking about, right? It's like that creates a tendency, creates a predisposition. Doesn't like create a lock, but that's a condition for what can come about in the future. And you can see, it's not like everything that everybody imagines immediately comes about. But when lots of people are focusing on certain kinds of things, or when people in certain key positions at certain key points turn their mind a certain direction, it does change the face of what's happening in the world very quickly, right? And there's all kinds of different levels and ways in which this statement by the Buddha is true about the mind creating the world. But anyway, that's just one way to think about it. So, in that context, you know, things not having kind of fixed nature in and of themselves, but being open to being transformed based on how we direct our minds. You know, we have this possibility of using our minds to cultivate, or pray for, aspire to. We can aspire to become Buddhas and think, well, it's possible for my mind to change in that kind of direction by cultivating that kind of attitude. So how could we make ourselves like, how can we get ourselves out of this truth habit, to use from Bob Thurman for a minute, like this addiction to an exaggerated kind of reality? It's like, I've just got to have more of that. And then clinging and grasping onto things as like objects that we can desire or hate because they have some intrinsic reality from their own side as being hateable or desirable. Well, one idea is we could just stop thinking like that. Did you see I Heart Huckabees? You see that movie? Did you, it was like, so in the beginning they had the blanket truth, right? But then later on they had the rock thing. The ball thing, right? And it's like Catherine Vauban, the existentialist, quasi-nihilist, you know, teacher, came and said, you guys just hit yourself in the face with this ball, right? And they're like, oh, yeah, that's, wow, man, I'm just, you know, it's like I'm not thinking anymore. I just finally got a little break. It's like, oh, you try it. It's like, wow, oh. For that, yeah, I got some relief there. I wasn't grasping onto anything. And it's like, and then he writes a poem about how it's like just being like a rock. I could become more like a rock if I could just like, if I could hit myself, you know, with this ball, I'll be, you know, rocks at peace, and I'm at peace as long as I keep hitting myself with the ball, right? Right. So there's one possible way, right? And according to Tsongkhapa, some Buddhists have been and still are doing something equivalent to that. And he doesn't like it. And he doesn't think it's helpful. And he's trying to say, look, this ball thing isn't going to work so well. Because you're not actually changing the way your mind, it's just like you've taken a little vacation from dualistic conceptual thought. You know, but then when the shock of the ball hitting your face wears off, you're like, oh gosh, I'd like to get some more of that ball, you know, or where, you know, maybe I can find that woman who taught me about the ball and she can teach me something else. And you're like right back into all the same things you're doing before, right? And then they're like fighting who has a closer relationship with the woman who teaches them how to hit themselves with the ball. And it's like no matter the amount of hitting themselves in the ball, they don't stop being jealous. And, you know, and so it's like it doesn't like magically relieve the root of cyclic existence of this reification. It just means for that amount of time that the force of that thought's not active because you don't have any thoughts, right? So the other way, which is like sounds harder, but is more likely to actually work, would be to learn a new way of thinking instead of just try to make yourself stop thinking. And that's what Tsongkhapa's teachings are all about. To say, like, well, let's do some analysis and think about whether things really exist. How is it that I'm thinking that I exist? What does it feel like to believe in myself as, you know, as existing objectively or intrinsically? You know, like, who do I think I am? You know, sit there and meditate and try to locate what your sense, what it feels like. How is it that you're thinking of yourself to exist? And then see whether you can find some graspable person that really exists, that's findable under analysis, that's really can be pinned down and grabbed hold of, that exists the way you reflexively are always taking it for granted that you are. And when you analyze in that way, then you find that the absence or lack of any graspable person such as you were imagined. And then you say, huh, that's interesting. Well, it slipped away from me this time, but I'm not convinced. So what? You have to do it again. And this is very important. You know, there's actually some kinds of Tibetan Buddhism that say, well, when you analyze the person and you realize that you know, that we thought that the person was real, and then we all this time, you know, we've had cyclic existence because we kept thinking the person was like had some graspable nature. And then when we do analysis, we realize the person is really empty. Whew, well, we're done with the root of cyclic existence now, but we have this new problem. Now we're grasping onto the thought that things are empty. We better get rid of that. Yeah. It's like that's the main new thing to be refuted is the thought that things are empty. Well, Tsongkhapa doesn't say like that. He says, look, this is a new thought that you're having. It's a very powerful thought. It doesn't just because you have this thought in one moment, you know, eradicate all your tendencies in this direction. Just as like we have this deeply ingrained habit to exaggerate how things are, we now have to train in or practice or cultivate, foster, nurture, and develop this new way of thinking by doing it a lot, by doing it over and over again in lots of different ways until it starts to become like second nature. So it starts to feel like not just this weird thing, but we start to become at home with thinking of ourselves as empty instead of thinking of ourselves as being filled up with some essence on the inside. So that's what Tsongkhapa is saying. You have to cultivate this thought. Now, eventually, of course, you do go beyond all dualistic conceptions. But it's not by just immediately getting rid of some new correct thought you've had. This is like a really powerful correct thought, so you want to cultivate it and develop it and foster it. Now, let me see how much time I have. Like, I'm supposed to stop in like a few minutes, or is that where?
Yeah, 10 seconds or something.
Very strict schedule today.
You can go on a little over, Diana says. Yeah.
I'm going to go a little over.
Timekeeper.
Okay, well, I just want to, I'll just do one more little piece of not very long. I don't have to be?
No, it's according to it now.
Maybe we'll just stay here all night. I was talking to Tom about that. He says he has enough tape. okay, well, I wanted to just say something about the place, just sketching the place of these ideas in the history of Buddhist thought, and Josh did a little bit alluding to that. Going from, you know, what the Buddha taught to what we're trying to do today, and sort of what some of the big dots.